It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is the Fox News Rundown Extra. I'm Lisa Brady. Around the world, many COVID restrictions are beginning to ease again as the Omicron surge subsides, but the debate over mandates continues in courts across America. A new Johns Hopkins study says lockdowns are ill-founded, including school and business closures and travel bans, and that they have little or no effect on the COVID mortality rate, cutting it by just 0.2% on average. It's an analysis of more than 20 other studies by researchers who screened many more before deciding which to include. We spoke with Dr. Marty McCary, a Johns Hopkins professor of surgery and health policy and Fox News medical contributor, about the study and Omicron and the continued push to vaccinate as many people as possible, including the new proposal for children under age 5. We made some edits for time and thought you might like to hear the whole thing. So thanks for listening. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the weekday Fox News Rundown podcast. Now here's Dr. Marty McCary on the Fox News Rundown Extra. I'm going to dive right in because I have so many questions for you. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay, excellent. So I wanted to start with the basic finding in this new study that lockdowns in general did very little to reduce death from COVID, if you will. Why is that?
Well, they looked at many factors, and one of the factors was that you may be spreading the virus in a more contagious setting if you're not at a workplace, if you're not at school, if you're not in a playground. And so when you are in an indoor area with other family members, that is sort of the perfect place to be able to spread things. The ventilation in most homes in America is not like the upper 1%, and the ventilation is poor. So they looked at the effects specifically of school closures, stay-at-home orders, business closures, and overall. And what they found is overall, the risk of mortality was 0.2%, 0.2%. And of course, we know many people died from excess mortality, that is other causes not related to COVID as a result of the lockdowns. And that's what we've got to factor. We've never really done a comparison of those two factors causing public health harm.
What about any impact on slowing the spread? So if the basic finding is this didn't help to really prevent deaths overall, what about slowing the spread at all? Did we have just as many cases even with lockdowns?
So the new analysis from Johns Hopkins really compiled many other studies. They looked at over 1,000 studies and then identified 24 that they felt had rigorous methodology. So some of those studies looked at transmission and others did not. But the general thought is that even with people not showing up in the workplace, there continued to be transmission in the community. And that is that we've had this assumption that if you are not at work, that you can't get it. But of course, you can get it from other other sources at and in the household or in the apartment building. Or, you know, people cannot stay confined in an international space station by themselves forever. So even when we have lockdowns, there's a lot of leakage. People have to get food. People have to, care for a family member who may be vulnerable and unable to take care of themselves. So there continued to be transmission just in a different setting. And this is particularly interesting when it comes to schools, because a classroom is generally going to have much better airflow and be around people who are more inefficient transmitters of the infection than, say, a household, which is the alternative to being in school.
Mm-hmm. There did seem to be a different result that was found when it comes to closing bars. I think it was like over a 10% impact on reducing mortality. I'm probably not saying that right, compared to a fraction of a percent for the overall picture of the study. Why is there more of an impact from closing bars? Is it because people tend to be in closer proximity when they're in a bar?
Yes, and the ventilation tends not to be as good in a bar, particularly in the European-style pubs. And remember, when you are in a location, it's a function of not only the airflow and ventilation, but how much air you're exhaling. And when you speak at higher volumes in a loud restaurant or pub, you tend to be exhaling more airborne particles. And so the ultimate sort of recipe for disaster is talking loudly for prolonged periods of time in congested spaces with poor ventilation. And I basically just described what many bars are like.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I guess it's like a million-dollar question. Okay, did COVID lockdowns do more harm than good based on these results?
So we don't have a head-to-head comparison, but what we do know now is if that the overall reduction of mortality was 0.2%, what were the results of the lockdown on death rates? We are just starting to get that data trickle in. We learned, for example, in the United States that 30,000 more people died of substance abuse in the first year of the pandemic than died pre-pandemic. Now, the pandemic's been about 2 years. That could have been higher the second year. It could have been a total of 70 or 80,000 Americans who have died from substance abuse more than pre-pandemic. So when we start parsing together the other causes of non-COVID death, or what we call excess non-COVID mortality, I believe it is very clear that we will have caused more harm than good. Now, it doesn't mean the strategy should not have been done. It just means it should have been targeted to the populations that were most vulnerable. And if there's one original sin with COVID in our policy, it has been that we've never really truly accepted that the risk is not equally distributed in the population. It is so heavily skewed towards vulnerable people, people with immune disorders, comorbidities, obesity, something we rarely talk about, and advanced age. And in those, for those individuals, they should take extreme precautions at a time when we had no interventions, no vaccines. And of course, now the calculus is radically different.
Right. And I guess that's also speaks to the overall difference between, you know, being at risk of catching it and being at risk of having severe impacts or death from it, which is a line that wasn't always emphasized. Especially in the beginning stages of it. People might hear this, though, and say, look, what were governments, not just in the U.S., but around the world, supposed to do? You're trying to get a handle on an airborne virus. You know, what does this research tell us for future pandemics or even future variants of this pandemic?
Sure. So, I think that's a very reasonable question, and we should all ask it because, by the way, this is not the only major pandemic of our lifetime. We have had just in the last 100 or so years, the Spanish flu of 1918, we've had polio, Zika, Ebola, SARS-1, H1N1, H1N3, MERS. We've had so many pandemics in the world in just our lifetime, you can better believe there's going to be more. So it's important to ask these questions. Now, the bigger question of should we have gone into lockdowns, in my opinion, the answer is, you do what you need to do based on the available data at the moment. Now, when we were watching this thing play out in China and in Italy, and that is how I sort of came to the forefront of this conversation, is I said, look, what we're watching in Italy is about to happen in the United States. And no one believed it. And sure enough, it was true. We didn't know if we were going to lose 1% of our nation's children because we did not have good data. So we needed to close schools, and I think we needed to tell people to stay at home to avoid the spread. But a temporary transient measure is very different from a long-term strategy. And what we should have immediately done is pivot when we got the data out of Northern Italy, that this is significantly skewed in the way it attacks older and vulnerable people. We never really made that pivot. We still haven't made it. Look at the people who are the recipients of the most strict and harsh restrictions in the United States today, children, the group where we know they are the absolute lowest risk people on earth. So I wrote an article a few months into the pandemic, once we had that data, and it was titled, "We Need to Reopen America by Taking Precautions, But We've Got to Learn to Live with This." And that was in the New York Times. They've fired the editors involved in that article, and they've never published anything else I've ever sent them.
Are you concerned that this research will only add fuel to, you know, a debate that's still very heated over pandemic restrictions?
Well, look, we have now one side of the ledger, and that is, what did the lockdowns do against mortality? They did very little. Now we are going to get the other side of the ledger, and that is, what is the excess non-COVID deaths? And as that data rolls in, and remember, typically it takes more time for that data because we're not just looking at immediate hospital deaths. Now we're studying people who had deferred cancer care and who developed opioid and fentanyl dependency, which may take years to truly take someone's life. So we're going to get more data, but already the trajectory of the non-COVID deaths is telling us that, in fact, we paid a heavy price in terms of lost lives to achieve a 0.2% reduction in mortality.
Now, just to be clear for people, because you're a professor with Johns Hopkins, were you part of a team or teams that went through and came up with this analysis, or is that separate from your work?
This is separate from my work. We have a big study coming out on natural immunity in our top medical journal, ironically, also this week. But this study was done by Dr. Hanke, a tremendous colleague and friend of mine at Johns Hopkins who does incredible work, a very senior researcher at Johns Hopkins. So he put out this study along with collaborators from Europe. I did find it curious, I must say, that the university did not put out a press release around this study, which is getting, you know, massive international attention. The last press release I saw from the university was that there was a new portrait that was going to be unveiled, which is an important reason to have a press release, especially given the individual. But it is curious that they did not in any way put out a press statement about this release. And I think it does speak to the larger issue of curated news coming out of academic institutions in America today.
Should we still be trying to vaccinate as many people as possible? And I ask this in part because of Pfizer's new application to give its COVID shots to kids as young as 6 months old.
Well, what we have falsely constructed was this thermometer of let's achieve 100%, and until we get there, no one's safe. And that ignores the fact that the risk is not equally distributed in younger populations. So what we've done is created this almost fundraising goal, if you will, that, you know, we're at 85%, we got to get to 90, now we got to get to 95%. The entire lexicon is flawed because what we should be talking about are the immune and non-immune members of our population and the high risk, medium, and low risk members of our population. So the most important thing is that we get those at risk immunized if they're not already immune. So we've got to recognize natural immunity. And there's a group maybe of 10 or 15 million adults in the United States right now with no immunity. And they are sitting ducks. This virus is coming after them and they are the ones still showing up at the hospital. And that's where we really need to focus our effort. The idea that, you know, that remaining percentage of the country that's not vaccinated are children and we have to race to get healthy kids vaccinated doesn't really align with the data that it's the kids with comorbid conditions that are really the ones who need that vaccinated protection if they haven't had it already from natural immunity. So that's where we should be putting all of our efforts is people with comorbidities. That includes kids with comorbidities. The idea that we haven't vaccinated every seven-month-year-old healthy baby, and that's why we're still suffering with this pandemic, that's not an accurate portrayal of what's happening.
What about the issue of waning immunity? I mean, the booster shot campaign seems to have kind of lost steam pretty quickly. Are we in danger of giving COVID the upper hand because of that?
We are in older Americans and vulnerable, immune compromised Americans. It appears they need a booster if nature has not already given them a booster through prior infection. And that is something, unfortunately, we're having trouble convincing people to do right now. Your older American who has not had COVID, they really should be getting a booster because the two-dose regimen should have been spread further apart. by putting those two doses 3 and 4 weeks apart with the mRNA vaccines, they functioned as one primer dose for some older people. We know older people generally don't mount strong immune responses. We see that with the flu shot every year. So now with the credibility of public health in the toilet, we're having a tough time really giving the nuanced message. And that is that boosters save lives for older people and people immunosuppressed. If they haven't had COVID, they really need the booster. And if you're younger, there's no evidence that boosters reduce hospitalizations. And if you had natural infection, there's no evidence you need a booster. Instead, what we see is this blanket boost every human being message to the point where colleges require it. And people are smart enough to realize it's not that simple and we're not getting good guidance.
What about Omicron? I'd be remiss if I didn't at least ask you a question about it, because the World Health Organization said this week that in the past 10 weeks, there have been 90 million cases reported, which was more than the whole first year of the pandemic. And it's, you know, considered milder, maybe on an individual basis, but you still have a lot of rising deaths in a lot of places because of the sheer volume of cases. You know, is there any chance that these case numbers are skewed in some way because we're doing more testing now? Or is it still the case that, you know, no matter how many tests we do, it doesn't even show the true number of cases?
Well, that's definitely true. We're not capturing all the cases. When you see 500,000 cases a day reported by the CDC, remember, this is not a stock tracker where the numbers are reflective of reality in real time. If there's 500,000 cases on a tracker, you can better believe there's 3 to 4 million out there in the community in a single day occurring. Now, we generally recognize that 25 to 50% of the world's population will get Omicron. Dr. Fauci has even said that everyone will either get it or be exposed to it now. So there's a broad acknowledgement of that. What's the harm that it's going to do? Well, again, if we recognize the risk is not equally distributed in the population, which we've never really fully done, we would recognize that for unboosted seniors and for non-immune adults, they can still get into trouble and show up in the hospital with Omicron. We did get a study out of the Kaiser Permanente Southern California division that looked at 52,000 cases of Omicron and found only one death in that group. Now, that would suggest that it's much more mild, but the numbers don't add up right now. There's a math problem with the daily death numbers in the United States, because the numbers they're reporting, which are over 2,000 deaths a day, are inconsistent with the doctors I'm talking to around the country, and they're inconsistent with that Kaiser study. So what may be happening is that those dying with an incidental COVID infection or a COVID infection that may have played a small part in the individual's death is getting attributed as a COVID death. And that may explain why the numbers are inflated. Now, they're still real and people are dying of COVID, and it's not to downplay that, but it may be half roughly of the numbers being reported. We don't have a good handle on that. The few hospitals in states that have reporting of how many people in the hospital have COVID incidentally versus are in there for COVID illness have basically reported out that 50 to 65% of people in the hospital just have an incidental COVID infection. And that's because it's everywhere right now. It's ubiquitous. If you test the nose, you know, of 100 Americans, 10 or 20 of them are going to light up positive, even if they have no symptoms. So we don't have a good handle on the death numbers, but I'll tell you, there's a math problem with the daily death count.
One last thing for you. I'm just wondering, how concerned are you about where things stand right now in this pandemic, entering year three?
Well, I'm feeling good about the fact that Omicron is burning through the population so quickly that the end is very close. And when I say the end, it's going to be the end of this wave. We're going to have more variants in the future, maybe next fall, maybe a couple of years from now. But statistically, mutations tend to be downward, that is less severe. And it's hard to imagine a virus more contagious than what we have now. So I do see good news on the horizon. But on the flip side, our pandemic preparedness is still terrible. And we have a more divided country than we've ever had. We've had public health officials dishonest, using political grandstanding, a paternalistic approach, suppressing research. We've seen academic bullying among researchers that have different opinions. We've seen an NIH leader, which has tried to weaponize the NIH by calling for a devastating takedown of different ideas. We've seen those who just have a different opinion labeled as fringe. So the politicalization of science itself is worse than it's ever been. And I hope we can repair that, because medical tribalism is going to hurt us with cancer and HIV and so many other areas where we really should be coming together and using an objective approach, not a political approach where scientists lose their objectivity. Let's be honest, early on in the pandemic, if you simply opposed everything coming out of the Trump administration, somebody might have been right a certain percentage of the time. But now it's a point where you cannot have any political allegiances. Otherwise, you're not going to be honest with the data.
Dr. Marty McCary, thank you as always for your time.
Thank you, Lisa.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, publisher of The Federalist, and I'm inviting you to join a new conversation with the smartest thinkers out there about the country and where we're going. Subscribe to the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.